invite you into a moment of imagining. If you find it helpful to imagine with your eyes closed, please feel free to do so. Now I want you to imagine a dark night in a forest. The ground is covered in a foot of snow. It is 4 a.m. The predators of the night have just gone to bed, and it's not quite time for those of twilight to rise. It's a time of peaceful silence. In this silence, the air feels close. In this silence, you stand there, alone and yet connected to all that is around you. In this time, 4 a.m, in the coldest of winter, I invite you to wonder about your surroundings. To be in that magical space of nature. One of the great gifts of the mind is the power of imagining. And so as you come back into this space thinking about the sermon today, I invite you into that mindset of wonder. There are so many themes that come from the various religious traditions that celebrate holidays this time of year. You can talk about darkness and light. You can talk about going inward. You can talk about the birth of children, themes within themes. But perhaps the most important one for a thoughtful mind is that of wonder, of embracing that which is beyond our capacity of knowing, of asking questions about those things which are complicated, about embracing the wonder that is this amazing world we live in. Each of us little specks on a giant planet that is a little speck in a giant solar system, that is a little speck in a giant galaxy, that is a little speck amongst millions of galaxies beyond which we don't have the capacity to know, but can wonder what's even beyond that. The miraculous in the real. As a humanist myself, I used to find this holiday a bit of a struggle. And me and my friends in high school would celebrate what we called Winter Festival, because we had many different religious traditions in our little cohort, and it seemed to be more balanced and diverse to have one common holiday that we could engage in. But at the heart of Winter Festival was community and family and friends and a time of being kind of outside the school year and outside of the world for a little bit and our own time of wonder and creativity. And for a group of weird, dorky, geeky, LGBTQ teens, there was no place better. It was a time to wonder about ourselves and to wonder about the world around us and to consider possibilities. And indeed, this season invites us into that space. It's a time apart in a way, a time set aside. And whether you are a person who celebrates Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or New Year's or none of it or solstice, it's a time of being in community and it's a time of recognizing that as a society, we do things just a little bit different. And not always does it have to do with shopping. Is a time of wonder and of engaging in a spirit of what I like to call moral imagination. And moral imagination invites us to use our thoughtfulness, our reason, and our insight, and our personal experience to imagine how the world might be different and transformed by one another and by the world around us. The moral imagination. Even in the story of Jesus, you hear the moral imagination at work. An infant born at a time of oppression, a king bent on killing a baby barely born, a 3 wise men outsiders to this land, who indeed faced their own oppression in this region. Coming to an infant and saying yes to life, to the wonder and miracle of the stars and the sky and the gift of life, of shepherds and animals, of the most unlikely bedfellows. And in this moral imagination, imagining the possibility that the world need not always be the way it has been. It's a world of possibility, of us imagining ethically how we might improve our lives. And in this day and age, as we face the struggles of conversations around race, around war, around illness, we need that moral imagining, that moral wonderment more than ever. It helps us into a new place. Solstice invites us to imagine a world of being connected with the earth, with the directions, with beings and entities beyond ourselves, of recognizing that feeling source that exists not just within people and animals, but within the world itself. And I would argue at the heart of a humanist life is the power of that moral imagination to help transform the world. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with humanism, I want to take a minute and explain. Humanism started around the mid-1800s as a concept and started to grow significantly after World War I. It essentially said that science and reason and the faculties of the human spirit were the foundations for change. Frequently, it set aside religion, but not always. And it certainly said that it was within humanity to heal the world. It had a rude awakening when World War I occurred. And people started to doubt the powers of people because so much violence had occurred at the hands of humanity and so many people had died, that faith in human endeavor and human capacity for change was called into question. It was around this time that two ministers, Reverend John Dietrich and Reverend Curtis Rees, founded what is called religious humanism. You will find Curtis Rees familiar because he was a minister in this congregation from 1913 to 1915. And in 1917, while he was a minister at the Des Moines congregation, he preached what was considered to be the first specifically humanist sermon. In that sermon, he essentially supported the value of democracy, the value of the mind, the importance of reason and logic, all of which are longtime Unitarian inherited values. For even in the 1500s, Unitarians argued against the Trinity with the pure use of reason and the Bible. In the early 1800s, our Unitarian forebears used reason to understand and read the Bible, and that has been a foundation of our religion since long before humanism, long before humanists and atheists began attending our congregations. The first humanist manifesto was signed in 1933. Reverend Curtis Rees was one of those signees. The majority of them were Unitarian ministers. It is also worth noting that all of them were white men. About 20 years later, the second humanist manifesto was signed by a mixture of white and African-American men. And by 1970, we started to see some women signing that manifesto. And today, humanism is very much alive. It is very active in the world. It is an international affair with people from all kinds of cultures and worldviews participating in it. The most recent declaration or manifestation of the Humanist Manifesto is now called the Amsterdam Declaration from 2002. And I find that one section of that declaration is particularly powerful when we're talking about this concept of wonder and of the moral imagination. They write, "Humanism is a life stance aiming at the maximum possible fulfillment through the cultivation of ethical and creative living, and offers an ethical and rational means of addressing the challenges of our times. Humanism can be a way of life for everyone, everywhere. Our primary task is to make human beings aware in the simplest terms of what humanism can mean to them and what it commits them to. By utilizing free inquiry, the power of science, and the creative imagination for the furtherance of peace and the service of compassion, we have confidence that we have the power, we have the means to solve the problems that confront us all. We call upon all who share this conviction to associate themselves with us in this endeavor. The power of science and creative imagination. Isn't that just a powerful thought all by itself? And it takes that science and that creative imagination to imagine ourselves out of some of the greatest struggles we face. Global warming, hunger, violence. Just recently, I watched the movie Interstellar. Anybody seen Interstellar yet? That is a spectacular movie. I'm still thinking about it and dreaming about it today. And in Interstellar, they use the best known science, particularly the science of Stephen Hawking and so many others, to imagine what might it mean that the world, the Earth, will not always be our home. The reality that at some point this planet will be done with us. And what might we do? Will we die off, or will we move on into the universe and find other homes? And it uses that moral imagination to try and figure out how we might get out of a situation of this Earth no longer being our place, our space. And it does it not just through science and reason, which it does wonderfully well, but it creates a thought experiment of what it means to also have community and heart be at the center of that imagined future. Whereas our humanists have said in their declaration, furtherance of peace and in the service of compassion. We teach our children to be in that wondering place. Any of you participate in Spirit Play Classroom teaching it? Our Spirit Play classroom is, I think, particularly hard for adults because you tell a story and then you ask wondering questions of the children. And the number one job of the person who's asking the questions is not to provide an answer. And inevitably, the adult fails. Because they want to say, well, have you thought about this and this and this? But the value of Spirit Play, the value of the way it is set up, is that we help our children use their own ethical imaginations, find their own strength and their own reason and experience. And when we don't provide the answers and let them wander into the world, they find their own path. And I have taught that class numerous times, and every time some kid asked a question that I'm thinking about weeks later, like, wow, where did that come from? The power of wondering and letting people wonder in their own ways. And yet it's hard for us to be in that space. As adults, I think it's worth learning to wonder without having an absolute answer. Wondering without having an absolute answer. And so Reverend Tom Owentoll puts it like this. We come to our religious values experientially. The beliefs we hold are not so much revealed to us as experienced by us. We encourage our children to develop their own working wisdoms instead of their inheriting the truth of their parents or of tradition. All who would participate in our Unitarian Universalist cradle-to-grave religious adventure have the opportunity to develop a faith that is personally meaningful, intellectually sound, socially relevant, and spiritually expressive. We are not ashamed to confess that truth comes in small installments. Those modest and well-lived insights are sufficient to sustain a fulfilling existence. Truth comes in small installments. I don't know about you, sometimes I get a little impatient for those installments to get a little bigger, or a little more, or a little faster. And yet, the spirit of this season, of the holiday season, reminds us to engage in wonder in such a way that's slow. I like the Advent calendar because it invites you into a day-by-day practice over a period of weeks of engaging in the wondering and the spirit of asking the questions of the season. It doesn't lead you into an absoluteness. And whether you believe in Christianity or not, I think the power of taking those small installments day by day, little bit by little bit, help feed our spirits, our minds, and give us the patience to have that moral imagination, the patience that it takes to solve some of the biggest problems of our world, because goodness knows it's not going to get solved in our lifetime, right? Anybody think we're going to solve racism in our lifetime? War? Hunger? It's not going to happen in our days, so small installments of the moral imagination. The holiday season invites us into an annually ritualized engagement with our senses, with our existence in the world. And utilizing our reason and our creativity, we can explore more deeply the beauty of the earth, the importance of people and of relationships, and the many gifts we have in our lives, both physical and immaterial. I'm going to close today by talking a little bit about Charles Hartshorne. He is a minister, was a minister, and a theologian. And I use theologian not as the full and thorough study of God as some man in the sky, because he was what is called a process theologian. And process theology uses reason and the knowledge of the allness of the universe, everything that we know and don't know, as a way to understand our world and our lives. He tells this story. He was serving as a soldier in World War I, and he was in France, and he was feeling pretty despairing. The war was tough. His life was a struggle. He was not feeling joy. It was not a good day. And he walked out to the edge of the cliff. He was kind of looking out and disparaging and not really feeling connected to the world. And at some point, he realized he heard this loud cacophony of sound. And at the base of the cliff, there were a group of French school children laughing wildly. And he realized in that moment that just because he was despairing and not seeing beauty in his own life did not mean that beauty didn't exist in the world. And he wrote it this way. He said, "Never since then have I allowed myself to identify, unless briefly, the question of is life good and beautiful with the question is my life now good and beautiful? And I have not wavered in the two convictions that there is some minimal good, beauty in life, including my own, and that what finally matters, even to me, is the life of the whole. The something that includes me outlasts me, save as I contribute to it, and contains more good than I can distinctly imagine. Contains more good than I can distinctly imagine." You ever have those days where you're just so down and out and you can't imagine any good in the world? Those are the moments when you want to remember there's more good in the world than you can possibly imagine. The essence of process thought is to engage in creative and rational existence with the wholeness of all things of which we are a part. And to understand that just because it is in our own experience, that is the limit of the possible. The world is alive with feelings and experiences all its own, and we are but small and miraculous piece of that world. We are but cells in the larger body of this planet, and this planet is but a cell in the larger body of the solar system, and the solar system a cell in the larger body of the galaxy, and so on. We are infinitesimal and yet relevant. The essence of process thought has four key components. I won't go into them deeply, but I think that they are relevant to our consideration of what does it mean to be in this season, in a time of wonderment and moral imagination, to be in a place that is outside and yet apart. The first key point of process theology is a reality that in all its manifestations, the world is both subjective and objective. There's a wonderful episode on Futurama. Yeah, Futurama is a cartoon. It's really kind of for adults. It's not really a kid's show. And at some point, they're watching this race. And person crosses the line, and one of the key characters loses a bet, and he says, oh, he observed it, so he changed the outcome, which is a great physics joke. The bottom line being that we have learned through science that sometimes the observer changes the reality, that the universe is both objective and subjective. We know this in a lot of different ways. In our race conversations, we know that there was a time in the 1800s when Thomas Jefferson said, science will discover that there is a key difference between people of different races. And guess what happened? Science proved that there was a key difference between different races. And guess what? It was wrong. We now know there's actually no scientific basis for a definition of race. The world is subjective and objective all at once. So one of the key things about the holiday season is a embrace of humbleness, of being humble in the world. And so, we must recognize that with all the power of our moral imagination, of our wonder, of our mentality, of our reason, we must recognize we are at once objective and subjective observers of our world, and therefore prone to be wrong. And also prone to be right. The second point is that at some incipient level, everything is alive. Even this wood, which within it has molecules moving so fast that we wouldn't be able to observe it. It would be beyond our capacity to understand. In a very literal way, this piece of wood on this pulpit is moving. The very seats on which you are sitting are moving so fast, you can't comprehend it, which is a good thing, because if they weren't moving that fast, you'd fall right through them. Everything is alive. The third point is that the whole defines its parts. And I think that that's something that's powerful within process thought. It isn't just that we are individual agents, and I think there is some comfort in thinking that as individuals we have great power. The truth is we're part of something bigger, and if that something bigger decides that it's done being a planet, we're kind of done, right? That's the level of, you know, we are a part of a system that's much greater than we are, and we have no control over it, which again leads to that humbleness of the season. And then the final one is that relationships form the matrix of mutual becoming. In other words, we create our world together. Sunshine alone on an island would go crazy. We'd probably start talking to a soccer ball like one Tom Hanks did. You know, any one of us would have that. But in community, we create meaning, we create possibility, and our own individual moral imaginations may not create a world that is better and more whole, but certainly together, that's another possibility. We are part of a miraculous world, intricately woven and ever-changing. And in this season of closeness and cold and chaos and calm, we are invited to pause for a time. We are invited to pause and to take stock. We're invited to take stock and be appreciative. Appreciative not just of our own experience, but of the wonderment that is out in the world and the universe and in the experiences of others. 4 o'clock in the morning, in a time of silence, is a great time to be in wonder. It was probably 2 a.m. My mother woke me up. I was 6 or 7 or 8 or 9. It happened almost every year. Get up, get up. Go outside. My father and I would go and put up chairs, sometimes in the snow, sometimes in the summer. My mom would make popcorn, and we'd sit down and watch the northern lights for hours. A time of wonder. In a time of space and silence. And I'm sure you have your own telling of such experiences. That is the stuff of the holiday season. That is the stuff of being a humanist in a holiday. A time of wonderment at the power and beauty of the world and of people. It isn't to say that there are moments of the mundane or even of deep struggle. It's a both and. Just as Hartshorne realized that joy happened in the world whether he felt it or not, we recognize that there is much to celebrate in life if we are hard-pressed to find it. Being humanist for the holidays means being in a state of reasoned appreciation. Being humanist for the holidays means being grateful for the miraculousness of the cosmos of which we are a part. It means engaging our moral imaginations to imagine the possible in the face of a broken world. And so may you be witness to small moments of wonder. May you embrace the power of the moral imagination that comes from this time of year. May you share that wonder with the world around you. May you share your own wisdom and be open to the wisdom beyond your own experience. In short, may you be fully human, small and yet a part of something larger. And may it be so.